KNW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Three women held hostage by Hamas freed today as a ceasefire deal in Gaza takes effect. ABC's Tom Sophie Borage in the West Bank, where crowds were celebrating the anticipated release of Palestinians held by Israel.
People here in the West Bank have very, very close ties to people in Gaza. Everybody knows someone. People have relatives. And we spoke to a young man, his sister, detained by the Israelis, been in prison for 9 months. The family, he says, has no idea why she was arrested.
The three former hostages from Gaza now being examined in an Israeli hospital. TikTok is back, the China-owned app resuming service in the U.S. today after President-elect Trump vowed to put a federal ban on hold when he takes office. But it appears for now that the app is still not available for download in the app stores. That's in line with the original language of the ban. Ahead of his inauguration, President-elect Trump today at Arlington National Cemetery was there for a wreath laying at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. This is ABC News. And with just 24 hours to go until President-elect Trump's second inauguration, the Capitol is undergoing some last-minute changes to accommodate a smaller, more intimate swearing-in. ABC's Perry Rumpson.
Workers are busy building a stage inside the Capitol Rotunda after the decision was made to move Monday's inaugural events indoors. The massive outdoor platform where the oath is normally taken can hold more than 1,000 people. The Rotunda can only hold about 600 guests. President Biden, members of Congress, and other notable guests will be there. But the vast majority of ticketed guests will not be able to attend the ceremonies in person.
Fire crews bracing for extreme winds coming this week as they continue to fight fires. More than a week after the Eaton and Palisades fires broke out in the Los Angeles area, firefighters are making major progress. The Eaton fire now 73% contained, while the Palisades is 43% contained. The blazes have left at least 27 dead. More than a dozen people are still missing. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Let's get back to live music in the lair with Kaylin Cole. The next song you have for us tonight is called 1103. Yes. Is that a time or a flight number?
Oh, that's actually really good. That's a good idea. I think I might have to write another song with that. You'll get 50%.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at MaxIncRadio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
No more mold, no more damage, no more slipping and hurting. Make your ordinary bathroom extraordinary for only $99 per month. New shower, new door, new tub, new wall, new anti-slip technology. BCI Bath and Shower is made in America for the highest quality. First 50 callers save $1,500 on a never-clear glass treated door. BCI Bath and Shower, interest-free financing options. 800-329-4115. 800-329-4115. 800-329-4115.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.fm.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Wisconsin has just added more than 30,000 acres to its protected agricultural lands, preserving the state's farming heritage and supporting conservation farming practices. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
Agricultural Enterprise Areas, or AEAs, are community-driven initiatives aimed at protecting farmland and boosting the local economy. Wednesday Coy with the state's Department of Agricultural, Trade, and Consumer Protection.
It's cool because we get to see what landowners identify as areas that are important to their local agricultural community, both economically and historically.
AEA landowners also contribute to conservation practices across the state by voluntarily signing agreements to use their land for agricultural purposes for a set time period and implement environmentally friendly farming methods. In return, they may be eligible for farm tax credits. Coy says the new Delavan Lake Watershed AEA serves to protect land near large lake attractions like Lake Geneva.
There are a lot of interests there in developing the area, but then there's also a lot of interest from their agricultural producers to protect the farmland that's there.
By designating these new AEAs, she says landowners and community members are taking proactive steps towards preventing development that could convert these lands to non-agricultural use. The latest areas across Sauk and Walworth counties add to the state's nearly 2 million acres of AEAs. Wisconsin now has 51 agricultural enterprise areas that span 140 towns and the Bad River Reservation. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Cold weather advisory in effect for today. We'll see sunny skies, highs between 0 and 5 above, but wind chills, they'll be down around 15 to 20 below 0 or colder thanks to a gusty northwest wind near 10 below tonight. It's 6 at our studios.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time as we will cover the inauguration in Washington, D.C., and also talk about who the next civil rights leader might be for Martin Luther King Day. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2. From Denmark to De Pere, this is 97.9 WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this remaining hour of our broadcast on this historic weekend before we inaugurate a new president. Talking in this hour with you, inviting your discussion at 855-752-4842. Be a part of our discussion. Our discussion focusing upon the powers of the presidency, a lot thinking about the oath of office that the president is going to be taking in just a few hours, that take care clause under Section 3, Article 2 of the Constitution, and also the role of the United States Supreme Court in all of these things, in understanding and giving us opinions, sometimes very controversial opinions, opinions sometimes that are opposed vehemently by people who are also reasonable out there. Nonetheless, the role of the Supreme Court in deciding major issues. And once again, just this past week, the Supreme Court weighed in an expedited way. When it wants to work quickly, it can and it does in this major case involving, yes, that's right, TikTok. The Supreme Court announcing just on Friday of this past week that it would enter this new battlefield in the culture wars, if you will, and said that in the end, a congressional enactment, a piece of legislation, a law that effectively bans the wildly popular app TikTok in the United States is in fact constitutional starting this weekend. The ruling ends, at least for now, a legal battle involving national security and free speech. And again, this cultural phenomenon that has had millions of Americans swiping their phone screens throughout the days of their lives. The ruling, which forces the app quite literally to go dark. And yes, indeed, as we're on the air this weekend, the leadership of TikTok has said it is going to go dark this weekend if it remains under Chinese control. And yes, that's the national security aspect of it. Could be a death blow to TikTok's American operations. Interestingly, President-elect Donald Trump, who is, again, set to be inaugurated the following day, this coming Monday, has vowed to save the app, even though early on in the campaign, he was all on board to bring it to conclusion. In ruling against TikTok just late this past week, unanimously, 9-0, all the justices across the political spectrum, if you will, the court acknowledged that this wide-ranging cultural impact of the app is important, but it sided with the government's concerns that China's role posed some legitimate national security concerns that Congress can act based upon its briefings about those considerations. The unanimous majority said there is no doubt that for more than 170 million Americans, TikTok offers a distinctive and expansive outlet for expression, a means of engagement, and a source of community. But went on to say this, the Supreme Court did. But Congress has determined that divestiture, that is getting rid of the parent company, that, according to the United States Congress and its findings of fact, has connections to the Chinese government, that divestiture is necessary to address its well-supported national security concerns regarding TikTok's data collection practices and relationship with a foreign adversary. Of course, all of this opposed by TikTok vehemently, alleging that there are two sets of First Amendment rights that are at play here that would be implicated and trounced upon if the Supreme Court were to do exactly what it now has done. There are the First Amendment rights of people who use TikTok on a regular basis. Again, hundreds of millions of people here in the United States of America who use it routinely, and an awful lot of people also saying that their businesses depend upon it. No small consideration. TikTok also maintaining that it itself has a First Amendment right to be heard and to provide this platform out there. Of course, all of this is a part of the decision by the United States Congress, very much aware of what it was doing. The United States Supreme Court then gets this on an appeal from TikTok. The United States Supreme Court telling us this: we are conscious that the cases before us involve new technologies with transformative capabilities. This challenging new context counsels caution on our part. And indeed, Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Neil Gorsuch issued some concurring opinions that agreed with the majority's decision to support the legislation, but question some of the ways in which they got there. So the government had offered two justifications for the law: that China's control of TikTok allowed it to harvest these troves of private data and to spread that covert disinformation through that access portal, if you will. The court accepted only the first rationale, saying that TikTok's ownership structure gave rise to this distinctive and troubling concern. The opinion of the Supreme Court saying this data collection and analysis is a common practice in this age, but TikTok's scale and susceptibility to foreign adversary control, together with the vast swaths of sensitive data the platform collects, justify differential treatment to address the government's national security concerns. All of this, again, in the context of this major dispute. The court went on to say, we are mindful that this law arises in the context in which national security and foreign policy concerns arise in connection with efforts to confront evolving threats in an area where information can be difficult to obtain and the impact of certain conduct difficult to assess. We thus afford the government's informed judgment — by government, they mean the Congress — substantial respect here. And again, the result is that the ban on TikTok in the United States takes effect this weekend on the 19th, one day before Donald Trump himself becomes the president of the United States of America. So what else do we know about this? Well, what happens next? That's the big issue. Again, the TikTok leadership has said it's going dark, and there are some options, we all assume, in the last hours here, but they're few and far between. If the law doesn't ban TikTok directly, as a result of the Supreme Court doing this, it will be unable to operate because ByteDance, which is the parent company here, is quite literally unable or unwilling to sell the app. Instead, and this is how it goes into effect, the TikTok authorities have said that the app stores themselves, like those operated, for example, by Apple and Google, and yes, indeed, this is very important, the cloud providers like Oracle cannot distribute the app. And that's how TikTok is brought down. For violating the law, for engaging in those operations, Apple, Google, Oracle, for violating the law, those companies could face penalties as high as $5,000 per user who is able to access the app. And again, there is no concern that an attempt to access the app, even after TikTok has gone dark, exposes any particular individual to any sort of penalties. It is the possibility of the penalties being imposed, $5,000 per user. TikTok says, again, it's got 170 million users in the United States of America alone, so those fines could indeed add up quickly. That's the enforcement piece of this. And of course, the other piece of this is purely political and purely governmental. President-elect Donald Trump, soon to be President Donald Trump, has said again late in his campaign that he was changing his position and is now considering an executive order to allow TikTok to continue operating in the United States of America. How interesting is that? But again, it is unclear if that executive order could effectively halt the ban. The ban, of course, again, going into effect hours before he is the president. And once again, implicating what we began our broadcast this weekend focusing on, the take care clause. An awful lot of people will say, well, gee, that's the legislation of the Congress that TikTok is banned, rightly or wrongly, based upon these security issues. Again, not dismissing the First Amendment issues, but the security issues greater than that. That's the determination of the Congress, now upheld by the Supreme Court unanimously. And the president has, under the Constitution, the obligation, yes, indeed, to take care that the laws of the country be faithfully executed. That will be the argument in opposition to Donald Trump doing anything to try to stop this. Legal experts have also said, of course, that he could direct the Justice Department not to enforce the law. Those are the folks who would enforce these penalties against Apple and Google and Oracle and others out there for attempting to sell the app. Again, the question comes whether or not the Justice Department has that authority, raises the larger issues that we've also discussed a lot on this broadcast about who is in charge of the Justice Department. Now, plainly, the Attorney General himself, likely the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monaco, will be resigning, if they have not already, as this broadcast goes on the air. And there will be other acting attorneys general and acting deputy attorneys general, acting assistant attorneys general there to keep more than keep the lights on, to keep the operations of government going. What is the issue? What is the relationship now between a White House and the Department of Justice? Will Donald Trump call those acting folks before Pam Bondi is confirmed by the Senate and ask those people or tell those people that they are not to enforce the law? Is that consistent with the take care clause? Is that the kind of thing that we want? Is that acceptable in our basic understanding of the norms between the White House and the Justice Department generally? This TikTok issue, important plainly in terms of First Amendment issues, commercial issues, those people who rely upon it for business. It's important to security issues, an international issue. But yes, indeed, it is perhaps one of the most important quick decisions that the Supreme Court has made this term, 2023, 2024, 2025, in recent years, one of the most important decisions it has made, because it also underscores the significance of the relationship between the presidency and the Department of Justice, the loyalty of people who may be there, the importance of applying the take care clause, the responsibility that the president has to faithfully execute the laws, in this case, to ensure that TikTok is not operating in violation, in compromise of our national security. Lots and lots of questions. Plainly, again, like other issues related to things like the 28th Amendment, going to survive not just the Biden administration, that has said it's going to leave all of these issues to the incoming president and the Trump administration, all of these things going to expand both the Biden administration into the Trump administration, not going away anytime soon, instead going to be a part of our national discourse, our national discussion about constitutional provisions, including the First Amendment, including the security of our nation, including the powers of the presidency. All of that continued as a part of our discussion here on Amicus, a Law Review.
This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. In the first week of the new session of the Wisconsin State Legislature, Republicans fast-tracked a measure that would put a question on the ballot in the upcoming spring election that would enshrine voter ID in the state constitution. Two things on this. First, it is telling that Republicans made this their very first order of business. Senate Democratic leader Dianne Hesselbein responded to this, saying it's not cost of living or health care or gun violence that Republicans wanted to focus on, but a constitutional amendment. Telling, isn't it? But that leads to the second piece. Republicans are clearly doing this for politically motivated reasons. By having this on the spring election ballot, they're betting it will make it more likely that people who showed up to vote for Donald Trump in November will be heading to the polls to help elect right-wing candidate Brad Schimmel to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. That election is on April 1st, so buckle up.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
My name is Jim Santel. This is Amicus, a Law Review. Once again, honored and pleased that you have chosen to spend some of your weekend talking about these major issues as we are on the cusp of a change in administrations in America. Lots of things going on in the area of the rule of law, including arguably an amendment to our Constitution, adding a 28th Equal Rights Amendment. A lot of things having to do with TikTok as well that will continue to be the focus of community discussion, but also litigation in the courts. The Supreme Court, of course, also entertaining other oral arguments just this past week. Let's talk about some of those. The Supreme Court right now has about 56 cases on its docket. We'll probably add a few more of those before it rests, if you will, with a number somewhere in the 60s. Likely that's what it's done recently. Sometimes gets into the 70s. And likely that all of the cases, including the four cases that it heard oral argument on this past week, will be decided in the weeks, months ahead, most often in May, June, sometimes even in July of the year. And so this past week, a number of cases, all of them on the 13th, 14th and 15th, Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, the Supreme Court very busy in entertaining these oral arguments. First case involving Hewitt versus United States. Hewitt versus United States on Monday, January 13th. An interesting case coming out of some legislation that Donald Trump signed in his first term called the First Step Act. That was a 2018 law that, among other things, reduced the mandatory minimum sentences. You've heard a lot about those when it comes to the federal imposition of federal sentences in our criminal courts for some types of federal drug and some gun crimes. The question, the issue before the court in these cases is just this. Is whether the sentence reductions in that First Step Act that basically reduce some of those minimum mandatories and other things that reduce the exposure of some certain categories of drug offenders and gun offenders, whether the sentences imposed in those cases should also benefit from the reductions in the sentencing guidelines and other statutory aspects. Those should apply retroactively or not. In other words, if you were originally sentenced before the law was enacted with the lesser penalties, should you get the benefit of those laws and basically be resentenced to a lesser sentence? That's called retroactivity. The Supreme Court wrestling with that just this past week in a case called Hewitt versus United States. There's another case called Stanley on the same day. Stanley versus City of Sanford, Florida. Karen Stanley retired early from firefighting in 2018. She expected most of her health insurance to be covered under the original terms of her job. She discovered that the city of Sanford that she was working for had changed its policy for those leaving because of a disability. And Stanley, most regrettably, have the debilitating Parkinson's disease. Rather than receiving an approximately $1,000 a month insurance subsidy until she turned 65, the 47-year-old retiring employee of the city was cut off after 2 years. And she has alleged that that's a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. She sues the city to protect her and other people with like disabilities from discrimination. It's a discrimination lawsuit. Could affect millions of Americans who retire. And again, in the midst of a disability, what is the scope of the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, that addressed by the United States Supreme Court just this past week. A couple of other cases on Tuesday, Thompson versus United States, a case involving false statements that may be misleading, but not necessarily false. Can those be subject to criminal prosecution in our federal courts? A case involving Walzer versus Halliburton has to do with some things called voluntary dismissals under Rule 41, a civil procedure process there. And then on Wednesday, this major case involving free speech once again, case called Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. Free Speech versus Paxton. It's a very significant case, again, coming out of Texas, as you can well imagine from the very name of the lawsuit in itself. Paxton, of course, is the attorney general of the state of Texas. Supreme Court hearing arguments on Wednesday in that case revolves around a Texas law. It's Texas HB 1181, requiring websites to verify the ages of people seeking adult content, including pornography. Now, some speech-free advocates, of course, are out there saying, members of the adult entertainment industry as well, saying that this kind of thing is a limitation, an unconstitutional limitation, a restriction, once again, on free speech under the First Amendment. They're seeking to block these laws from going ahead. And they're represented, of course, by the American Civil Liberties Union, among others in that case. The litigation, the challenge, again, before the Supreme Court just this past week, again, whether or not the states can effectively implement this age verification method to limit access by underage youth. Again, a First Amendment issue, a free speech issue, but arguably also a commercial issue, right? And so the implications under the First Amendment and in other areas are significant as the Supreme Court goes ahead. Interestingly, the case less about the specific aspects of that, but more about the standard of review to apply to a law like this. While that seems very technical and very wonky and, yes, indeed, very legal, and it is, it's actually very important because sometimes the Supreme Court will say, especially when it comes to things like free speech, that we're going to apply what's called the strict scrutiny. That's the highest level of scrutiny. We're not going to permit the government, whether it's the federal legislature, a state legislature, to get by, to permit them to go ahead and limit these all important, kind of sacrosanct First Amendment rights, absent some very, very high-level, compelling reasons to do so. That's strict scrutiny. And what that means, of course, is the lower courts, when they're examining laws of this sort that are said to interfere with speech, this very important thing in our Constitution, in our national life, they look very, very closely to scrutinize what government is doing and have to identify at a very high level a lot of strict scrutiny, whether the government has some legitimate purpose in doing this because First Amendment rights are so critically important. Standard of scrutiny, always, always hugely important here. And of course, a bit tricky here because adults are recognized to have a free speech internet right in looking at these things. And so if you're an adult, plainly the law doesn't apply to you. The courts have said, yes, indeed, you have access. That's your First Amendment right, at least under the Supreme Court's case law to this point. But the issue in this free speech versus Paxton case, of course, is what about youth? Children, do they have a First Amendment right? Well, an awful lot of people say don't have a First Amendment right at all. And so it is complicated. What the Texas law here purports to say is that we're going to verify the age of anybody who is looking at these sites, or at least the content of most of these sites, and distinguish between the people who have no First Amendment rights, that is the youth, as they argue, and the people who do have First Amendment rights, and those are adults. What the challengers are saying, of course, is that by doing that, making that distinction, again, the challengers represented by the ACLU here, the adult entertainment industry, free speech advocates, others out there, they say what you're doing is you're interfering with the adults who do have First Amendment rights, and that's inappropriate, and that is unconstitutional. Fascinating issue once again. Again, a lot of the Supreme Court decisions these days affecting free speech rights in America. We'll hear more about that, to be sure, in the spring and summer of this year. As we come back here on Amicus, more on what is on the docket of the Supreme Court in 2025 and beyond. Stay with us.
From Ashwaubenon to Alloway, this is 97.9 WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Three women held hostage by Hamas freed today as a ceasefire deal in Gaza takes effect. ABC's Tom Sophie Borage in the West Bank, where crowds were celebrating the anticipated release of Palestinians held by Israel.
People here in the West Bank have very, very close ties to people in Gaza. Everybody knows someone. People have relatives. And we spoke to a young man, his sister, detained by the Israelis, been in prison for 9 months. The family, he says, has no idea why she was arrested.
The three former hostages from Gaza now being examined in an Israeli hospital. TikTok is back, the China-owned app resuming service in the U.S. today after President-elect Trump vowed to put a federal ban on hold when he takes office. But it appears for now that the app is still not available for download in the app stores. That's in line with the original language of the ban. Ahead of his inauguration, President-elect Trump today at Arlington National Cemetery was there for a wreath laying at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Badgers win in L.A. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Men's basketball, Wisconsin faced USC for the first time in the Big Ten Conference, and the Badgers came out on top, 84-69. Wisconsin held off the Trojans after they scored 13 unanswered points in the second half. Head coach Greg Gard.
Defensively, to be able to catch ourselves after that first 5 to 7 minutes when they made a run back at us, and I think the moxie of the group, they didn't panic. I think that's what makes this team really, really good, is that we have a lot of pieces and a lot of weapons.
The Badgers have now won 7 in a row. Number 7th ranked Marquette falling short at home to Xavier, 59-57. The Golden Eagles unable to score during a 5-minute period down the stretch. Coach Shaka Smart.
Congrats to Xavier. They came in here with phenomenal force and aggressiveness. It's a 19-point game on our home floor with about 15 to play. That's 1,000% a testament to them and how they played.
NBA, the Bucks host the 76ers tonight. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Cold weather advisory in effect for today. We'll see sunny skies, highs between 0 and 5 above, but wind chills, they'll be down around 15 to 20 below zero or colder thanks to a gusty northwest wind near 10 below tonight. It's 6 at our studios.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time and skip the regular line at the airport and pay for speedy security. Imagine not having to quickly unpack and pack at the place you already came packed to. And wearing your shoes the whole time you're there? You can't put a price on that kind of luxury. Well, actually you can, and you paid for it. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time for speedy security. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Native American voters prevailed in federal court against the state of North Dakota, protecting the ability to elect the candidate of their choice. January 13th, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear a redistricting case we covered back in May 2024, affirming a North Dakota federal appeals court decision. The appeals court had dismissed a state house district challenge by two non-native residents who claimed their rights were infringed. The case dates back to 2021 when the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara nations, also known as the MHA nation, negotiated with the state to protect native voting power under the 1965 Voting Rights Act, Section 2. After an agreement, state GOP officials later shamefully reversed positions in 2022, embracing a new GOP tactic which argues such majority-minority districts are a violation of the Equal Protection Clause under the U.S. Constitution. The same argument has been made in Robinson v. Calais over Louisiana's now two majority-minority districts. The MHA Nation decision protects North Dakota State House District 4A and three other districts. Great news for Native voters. But the Louisiana case is expected to be heard in the High Court in early 2025, and the conservative justices seem to have made it their mission to dismantle the VRA. We have links to the history of the case at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Dom Selvia.
Jess P.S., Dom's producer here.
Next time, it's Inauguration Day. Tune in to hear some historical context and perspective from our favorite Delano Democrat, Harvey Kay.
The Dom Salvia Show, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. We are continuing with our discussion of the United States Supreme Court, as we often do. Lots of things going on that are going to affect, already have affected, our lives and livelihoods here in the United States of America. The Supreme Court right now at 56 cases altogether, still accepting new cases as it goes forward in this term, including just late this past week, Supreme Court announcing that it's going to enter yet another one of these culture war areas. It agreed to decide whether the Constitution of the United States of America guarantees parents of students in public schools the right to have their children excused from classroom discussion of storybooks featuring LGBTQIA characters and themes. Montgomery County Public Schools, Maryland's largest school system, had adopted a new curriculum in 2022. It included, its lawyers said in its application to the Supreme Court, a handful of storybooks featuring lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer characters for use in the language arts curriculum, alongside many books already in the curriculum that feature homosexual characters in traditional gender roles. That according to what the petition is from the school board. In the past few years, of course, the Supreme Court has wrestled a lot with the role of religion, and including many things involving the rights of gay rights in our society. Recent cases, the court has ruled, as you recall well, in favor of a web designer who said she did not want to create sites for same-sex marriages. Supreme Court ruled in favor of a high school football coach who said he had a constitutional right to pray at the 50-yard line after his team's games. Also in favor of a Catholic social services agency in Philadelphia that said it could defy city rules and refuse to work with same-sex couples who had applied to take in foster children. Lots of cases in recent terms addressing the interplay between religion and LGBTQIA rights. And again, back in the United States Supreme Court on this case as well. The school system in this new case, which comes out of Washington suburbs, at first gave parents notice when the storybooks would be discussed, along with the opportunity to have their children excused from those sessions. But the school system changed that policy, permitting excuses for the students. The lawyers said the growing number of opt-out requests gave rise to three related concerns: high student absenteeism, the infeasibility of administering opt-out classrooms in schools, and the risk of exposing students who believe the storybooks represent them and their families to social stigma and isolation. A lot going on there, a lot to unpack. Again, the Supreme Court going to decide whether there's a constitutional right, whether the school system is right in its policy, now changed, permitting this opt-out process. Constitutional guarantees the rights of parents to have their children excused from the discussion of LGBT issues and characters in a school setting. Again, important issues before the Supreme Court. We know that in the coming week, the Supreme Court is going to be taking up more cases. One of them, again, in the administrative area. A case called McLaughlin Chiropractic versus McKesson. This is once again one of those cases involving the administrative state, which has been the subject of an awful lot of focus by the Supreme Court. This one has to do with whether or not the FCC acted properly, whether or not the courts should defer to the administrative agency's legal interpretation of certain laws. Yes, indeed, that issue is back again, being argued in this McKesson case on Tuesday of this coming week, right after Inauguration Day. On Wednesday, a law enforcement case. This one involving something called the Moment of Threat Doctrine, having to do with how our police behave in connection with intersections of police activity and law enforcement, safety and security, and actions with respect to particular members of our community. Moment of Threat Doctrine, a law enforcement matter, a criminal law enforcement matter, appearing in front of the Supreme Court this Wednesday in a case called Barnes versus Felix. In connection with all of that, of course, we've got other executive action that is not subject to judicial review, as we know. We've talked a lot in this broadcast about the powers of the executive to act under Article 2, various sections of that article, including, of course, one we haven't discussed yet in this broadcast, and that is the power of the pardon. We know that Joe Biden has done a lot of this in recent times, and indeed on Friday, the same day that he declared his position that we have a 28th Amendment to the Constitution, he also announced that he would commute the sentences of nearly 2,500 inmates who are serving long prison terms for, once again, nonviolent drug offenses. That's the broadest commutation of individual sentences ever issued by a United States president. Again, what is a pardon? A pardon is forgiveness. It is an extension of largesse, and it basically wipes away the criminal judgment. A commutation is a reduction in the sentence that is imposed, either to time served, to some other period of time in prison. It is a reduction, but does not eliminate the judgment itself. President Biden said this action is an important step toward righting historic wrongs, correcting sentencing disparities, and providing deserving individuals the opportunity to return to their families and communities after spending far too much time behind bars. Of course, the clemency powers, we've seen that a lot by this president and other presidents as well. He's also commuted the sentences of nearly all prisoners on federal death row. Interestingly, Two of them declined to accept those commutations. That's significant because, once again, it comments upon the pardon authority and the fact that someone who is being granted a pardon, granted a commutation, can indeed refuse that commutation, that pardon. And that's setting a single-day record of 1,500 commutations for those involved in some home confinement during the pandemic. That's another aspect of what the president did, a single-day record up to that point of 1,500 commutations for those people who moved to home confinement during the COVID pandemic. The president has said that he's considering additional pardons, and we'll see what those are in the remaining hours of his presidency. These latest commutations actually relate back to that issue that we talked about earlier in that Hewitt case that's, again, before the United States Supreme Court, the oral argument of just this past week. Here again, having to do with the imposition of federal sentences for people involved in nonviolent drug offenses. Joe Biden said that these commutations would help those who receive sentences based on these now discredited distinctions between crack and powder cocaine. You remember this debate from years ago? Or face some inflated charges for the drug crimes he is trying to remedy in the wake of our better sense of how to administer the laws, the kinds of things that we should do with respect to people involved in nonviolent drug crimes. He said that his statement was following the lead of Congress, his action here following what Congress has already done, which over the past two decades in doing things like passing the First Step Act, doing other things to remedy this decades-long disparity involving tough-on-crime laws, including things like mandatory minimum sentences. This issue related to crack and powder cocaine has also been involved in race. And there are an awful lot of people who identify the statistics that show that because of the distinction inside the law between sentences for crack powder as opposed to powder cocaine, because of that, people of color are inordinately given higher sentences than people who are not of color. And again, that is a part of the initiative by our current president to address racial issues inside our sentencing practices, commuting the sentences of nearly 2,500 drug offenders, again, aimed at inmates who received harsher sentences based upon these old disparities in the drug laws Biggest commutation, greatest commutation of individual sentences ever issued by a United States president just this past week. And then we also go back to the incoming president himself. And that is the major issue having to do with the now dismissed cases against him. At least one of them also the subject of this major report by the special counsel. His name, you may recall well, is Jack Smith. He has concluded not only his term of service as the special counsel, his term with the Department of Justice. He has left the Department of Justice, but not before issuing through the Attorney General, basically authoring two reports, one of them on what he would have prosecuted, what the trial against Donald Trump would have shown if indeed it had gone ahead and proceeded before Tanya Chutkan, who was the district court judge there in Washington, D.C., was presiding over that insurrection case, that election interference case. Jack Smith, as a part of his commission, the legislation establishing special counsel, issued two volumes of a report. The first one on that insurrection, that election interference prosecution, now dismissed, describing what he would have presented. The second one, not yet released by the Department of Justice, having to do with what that prosecution would have shown in the Mar-a-Lago documents case, the classified documents, other documents to which Donald Trump was not entitled. The Attorney General just this past week releasing the first volume of those two. He should release both of them as a part of his role as our chief federal law enforcement officer. That obviously a subject of continued focus between administrations as the Biden administration becomes, if you will, inside the White House, the Trump administration. But we do have the special counsel report of just this past week saying that the special counsel, the Department of Justice, stands fully behind the merits of that interference prosecution. And it basically is an extraordinary rebuke of the president-elect Donald Trump as he takes the oath of office just hours away. This is what the special counsel wrote. He said, the department's view that the Constitution prohibits the continued indictment and prosecution of a president is categorical and does not turn on the gravity of the crimes charged, the strength of the government's proof, or the merits of the prosecution, which the office stands fully behind. That's a way of saying that he, Jack Smith, the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, compelled by virtue of this, I would offer, anachronistic policy that mandates that the Department of Justice not prosecute a sitting president. Jack Smith writing that our view of the Constitution and that policy prohibit our continued prosecution. That's the reason why this case has not gone ahead. Yet, he goes on to say this, but for Trump's election and imminent return to the presidency, the office assessed, meaning the office of the special counsel assessed, that the admissible evidence was sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction at law. So what are some of the big takeaways from this report? Again, the final word on this prosecution now dismissed coming out of this report. Well, we know a number of things. 250 people who were a part of the grand jury system, they appeared and provided testimony. Grand jurors, 55 witnesses before the grand jury, 200 of them interviewed during the course of this investigation. Some, of course, after lengthy battles over things like executive privilege, about which we have spoken at great length. Jack Smith said that the work of the House committee that separately examined the Capitol attack was only a small part, interestingly, of the office's investigative record. Here's the big takeaway. In what amounted to the report's most important finding, Jack Smith asserted that he was confident that his team of prosecutors and investigators had amassed enough evidence to convict Donald Trump if this case were to go to trial. The report spent about 30 pages altogether recounting in great detail how Donald Trump engaged in multiple conspiracies. Much of that, of course, is already in our public view through the indictment of the case. There was that lengthy evidentiary memorandum that we also know well that he filed in October, part of the fallout from the Supreme Court's ruling on immunities. But Mr. Smith, Jack Smith, went on to say that the office, the Department of Justice, stands fully behind both the strength of the government's proof had we gone to trial and the merits of the prosecution. Despite those major setbacks in the 2 years of this prosecution, he is sticking by the core allegations leveled against Donald Trump. He says the through line of all of Donald Trump's criminal efforts was deceit, knowingly false claims of election fraud, and the evidence.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
There was a time when barbecue was perfect. A strong, reliable flavor that could be counted on. But then big manufacturers decided that barbecue needed to be zesty or spicy or sweeter or whatever. If you miss the good old days of great tasting barbecue, we'd like to introduce you to Grandpa's Barbecue. Made in small batches from Grandpa's original recipe. Buy yours online today at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
Hey, it's John Mino.
And Jim Schmidt from Mino and the Mayor.
Want to stay in the loop with all things Northeast Wisconsin? Sign up for the WGBW weekly newsletter.
Get the latest local stories, updates on the weather, and a special feature from our Mino and the Mayor podcast.
It's your one-stop shop for real news and great conversation in Northeast Wisconsin.
Log on to WGBW.FM today and get signed up.
Real news, great conversation. Sign up today at WGBW.FM/newsletter.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
In the strength of the First Amendment protections for free speech, Smith said he never explicitly accused Donald Trump of inciting the riot by his supporters at the Capitol on January 6th. His indictment and the other court filings put a heavier emphasis on Donald Trump's actions in the weeks and months leading up to that attack. All of that very important as a part of the understanding of this report that was just issued just this past week. He also identified along the way a huge amount of focus here having to do with the targets of the investigation. In many corruption and conspiracy investigations, Jack Smith said, the target of the inquiry is often able to wield influence over witnesses or raise legal obstacles that stymie the prosecutor's ability to get evidence. He said that Donald Trump was particularly a difficult subject of an investigation, given his political and financial status and the power to command attention, especially on social media, acknowledging that his team devoted enormous amounts of time consuming litigation, intended to prevent witness intimidation, and giving Donald Trump extrajudicial comments, those extrajudicial comments he was making, sometimes of a threatening nature about the case, an awful lot of focus that he was required, therefore, to follow up on. The special counsel, of course, also described in great detail all of those court fights that were both in the public domain. And finally, he also defended his term in office and defended the team as well. He said that his professionals surrounding him, a decidedly very committed group of people of great decency, the highest personal integrity out there, who endured not only intense public scrutiny, but also threats to their safety. All of that as a part of the report issued by Jack Smith just this past week. When we come back here on Amicus Law Review, more about the courts in America and what they can and should be doing in the days and weeks and years just ahead. This is Amicus. Hello, radio. My name is Jim Santel. This is the last segment in our pre-inauguration broadcast. We, of course, will continue to follow all of these issues, including these issues of the important report issued by Jack Smith, special counsel, just this past week, among other things, talking about the professionalism of his staff, talking about the strength of the evidence against Donald Trump, and saying without equivocation that had that case, that interference case, gone to trial, Donald Trump would have been convicted for violations of federal law in connection with the indictment returned against him. No small thing to keep in mind as our president is inaugurated. Of course, he is also, as we know, based upon the judgment entered in the Manhattan trial court, the criminal court there by Judge Juan Merchan in Manhattan in New York, Donald Trump remains a convicted felon. Even though these other federal cases did not go to trial, even though that state case in Georgia, plainly, probably not seeing the light of day anytime soon, even though those cases did not result in a judgment, that one did, the one in Manhattan. And so Donald Trump goes into the presidency as the first convicted felon in our nation's history. Jack Smith telling us that had these other cases, or at least the one involving election interference, gone ahead, he would have also been convicted of federal offenses for his involvement in attempting to throw the 2020 election in an opposite direction. All of that leading to our final comments of this broadcast, and that is something we began to talk about many weeks ago, and that is, what are the guardrails? What are the standards that all presidents need to abide by? Yes, indeed, there is that all-important take care clause of the Constitution that should be the source of restriction, some limitation, some observance, if nothing more, by any president who is required to faithfully execute the laws. But what about these concerns that are still out there? President-elect Trump has recently once again threatened to lock up political foes, like Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. On the campaign trail, he said repeatedly that we encourage the Justice Department and the FBI to go after his enemies. His picks for attorney general, her name is Pam Bondi. She got her review before the Senate Judiciary Committee just this past week. FBI Director Kash Patel designee have also echoed those remarks. And there may even be an enemies list out there, including Christopher Wray and General Mark Milley. All of that raising again the issues of what could happen as a result of that notion of going after political foes, people who have been opposed to you in the past. And the focus, of course, should be upon judges. We spend a lot of time here on Amicus talking about the role, yes, of Supreme Court justices, but also appellate court judges and especially district court judges. The impulse, of course, beyond leadership at Maine Justice and in Washington, D.C. from the White House, may well trickle down to the district courts themselves. Again, we know that the president is going to be likely dismissing, as every president does, the current Biden U.S. attorneys. Many of them are already leaving those positions. He will appoint new U.S. attorneys. They will be subject to Senate judiciary review. And they will be responsible in many ways for pursuing, if indeed this inappropriate and unconstitutional and violative of our basic norms approach to go after political rivals is in part of the president's agenda. Those U.S. attorneys will have some significant questions to ask themselves about whether or not they will be a part of that process. But if indeed the United States Department of Justice, whether through U.S. attorneys or prosecutors at Maine Justice, decide to pursue investigations, there are limitations. There are restrictions. There are guideposts along the way. Suppose, for example, a federal district court judge is asked to sign off on all sorts of things, an eavesdropping warrant under Title III of the federal criminal law, a search warrant for the review, the entry into a home, a building. All of that has got to be reviewed by federal district court judges who've got to be able to assess whether or not there is probable cause. We're going to talk more about the role of judges in this coming administration, in all administrations.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Maggie Dawn Show.
Earl
Ingram.
On the next show, we'll discuss the life and presidency of Jimmy Carter with journalist and political consultant Candy Stroud before spending some time honoring Dr. King's holiday.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings at 9.
Hi, I'm Samuel L. Jackson. When the UNCF, the United Negro College Fund, was founded 80 years ago, they hoped that they could change this nation for the better, and they have. As a proud alum of an HBCU, Morehouse College, I'm an advocate for HBCU. I support the work that UNCF does for students of color, scholarship, and internship for 50,000 deserving students each year. Visit uncf.org today, and remember, a mind is a terrible thing to waste.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
This is 97.9 WGBW Denmark, Green Bay's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media radio station.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. The first phase of a ceasefire agreement in Gaza is now in effect. More hostages released today in exchange for Palestinian prisoners held in Israel. ABC's Ian Pendles in Tel Aviv's Hostage Square, where hostage families rallied every week for more than a year.
Incredibly emotional scenes in Hostages Square today. People were cheering, people were clapping, people were chanting, get them all out.
Meanwhile, a source in the Gaza Interior Ministry telling ABC News that more than 550 humanitarian aid trucks have entered through checkpoints since the ceasefire began this morning, a massive increase. Despite an international outage intentional from TikTok and then an announcement reinstating the app to U.S. users and crediting President-elect Trump, internet service providers and app stores still seem to be complying with a new law that bans their allowing the download and updating of the Chinese-owned app in the U.S. Trump said he will pause the ban. This is ABC News.